Vincent O'Malley is with us today, an historian and author of the New Zealand Wars, Ngā Pakanga o Aotearoa. But he also has a new release coming called The Voices from the New Zealand Wars, and he's going to talk to that as part of Te Pūtake o Te Riri, the National Day to commemorate the New Zealand Wars, which is today. Thank you for joining us on Pāke Waha today, Vincent. Tēnā koe.
Kia ora, pal.
Good to talk again. And look, I know you've got a lot of skin in the game. You've had a look at the Riri more than anyone else I know. Congratulations on the Puka Puka, which was so widely and well received. How will the New Zealand Wars, well, I guess we used to call them the Māori Land Wars or the Māori Wars, how are they to be commemorated?
Well, unfortunately, the scheduled commemorations in Waikato this year have been postponed for the second year running, so fingers crossed for next year. But you know, the Rā Maumahara, Te Pūtake o Te Riri, is a day that was first commemorated in March 2018 at Kororarika in Northland. And, of course, that followed the efforts of those wonderful students from Otahonga College who presented their petition to Parliament in 2015 calling for a National Day of Commemoration, actually for all of the victims of the New Zealand Wars, Māori and Pākehā.
Do you call them the New Zealand Wars? Should we? It's not a term that we, I suppose, learnt about in our history classes or in social studies when we were kids. What do you make of that? How do you prefer to reference them?
Well, I do use the term New Zealand Wars because I think that these were defining conflicts in terms of New Zealand's future. And I think it's interesting because what the wars are called reflects changing understandings of their causes and who was involved. So, you know, the phrase that many people grew up with was the Māori Wars, but the problem with that term is that it renders the other combatants in these conflicts invisible. But that kind of reflected the British practice of naming wars after their enemies or after countries that they had invaded. So, you know, you had the Zulu War, the Boer War, and so on, the Indian Mutiny. And that kind of reflected that. Later on, you have land wars. It becomes quite popular, especially in the 1960s, 1970s onwards. But problem with that, of course, land was a big part of the reason for the wars, but it wasn't just about land. In fact, Moana Jackson came up with the term sovereignty wars, which I think is a really interesting concept and probably speaks to the idea that these were conflicts for control of the nation, really, because what a lot of people don't realise is that when Te Tiriti was signed in 1840, it didn't really change things on the ground in many districts. Māori continued to control their own affairs as they always had. And it was really these conflicts in the 1860s, from 1860 to 1872, that determined the balance of power after that time. So the settler government achieves enough through those conflicts to establish its authority, and as a result of that, you see really Te Tiriti is thrown out the window for the next century or more.
It's interesting, isn't it? I've always sort of noted that in the history practices of Pākehā, it seems to be like a litany of skirmishes, and that we gauge history by the various battles that occurred. Have you given much consideration, Vincent, to whether that is a Pākehā construct or our Māori pre-European? When we catalogued history, it tended to be about people rather than about whaewhae. Is that gauging or cataloguing of history a particularly Pākehā way of seeing our past?
I think so, and I think also one of the differences really is that Māori understand much better the way that this history seeps into the present. It's not something remote or distant. It's not ancient history. It's something that we kind of live with, and we live with the consequences of those conflicts, whether that's in socioeconomic statistics or a range of other factors, really. So I think that, you know, the immediacy of this history is much more apparent to many Māori. But I think Pākehā are starting to turn a corner on that, and there is a greater willingness to engage with this history to understand it and to understand how it resonates into the present as well.
So the New Zealand Wars could still, looking back, have a major influence on some of our Māori societal challenges, health, poor health, income, education, etc. The legacy of the wars of this period, the 1860, could still be living out today.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't realise is that through the 1840s and 1850s, Māori dominate the New Zealand economy. Most of New Zealand's export income has been derived from Māori producers. You know, wheat has been exported to the goldfields in Australia and even California. And that kind of, that thriving economy is really destroyed almost literally overnight in the 1860s. And that's not something that those communities recover from easily. It, you know, that resonates over generations. And one example would be that in 1900, the most of Māori rendered landless as a result of land confiscations, and there are about 3,500 names on that list, and they're the names of heads of family, so each name really represents a whānau that's been dispossessed and probably suffered exile and all sorts of other things as well. And, you know, so that's 40 years after these conflicts, and obviously that continues through the 20th century as well, and that continues down to today. So that's one example of how we live with a consequence. Another would be that, you have the series of wars beginning in 1860, Waikato War 1863-64. Within 12 months of that, you have the Native Land Court established by 1865, which has been described as an engine of destruction for Māori society. 2 years later, you get the Native School System established, and that's an engine of assimilation, really. So one strips Māori of their land and the other of their language, and neither would have been possible without the New Zealand Wars, really. And so those are other consequences of these conflicts.
On a day like today, and as we weave more of our localised history into our curriculum, would you like the Tauira of tomorrow to be learning about the battles, or indeed about our sophisticated economic structure preceding the battles? Because it seems so intimately intertwined here. What would you like to see our young people coming up in the next generations of Aotearoa learning about this day and this situation?
I think when we talk about the New Zealand Wars, we're not talking just about military history. When I write about these conflicts, I'm trying to tell those histories at a human level about the impact of those conflicts on communities, and how that resonates over time. So it's not just about what took place on a particular battlefield or other sites like Rangiafia where people are attacked. It's about how that in order to understand those conflicts, you need to understand the before and after as well, which is why, for example, my book, The Great War for New Zealand, is subtitled Waikato 1800 to 2000, because I think in order to understand that invasion, you also need to understand the before and the after and how this history continues over time.
Does it surprise you that Māori are taking offence to many of the leaders of the war from the non-Māori side are somewhat immortalised in statues and street names, and how upsetting, in fact infuriating, that could be even to modern Māori, who I guess we're acknowledging could still be suffering from a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if you're growing up in a town like Kihiki, you'll probably live on a street named after a military officer or politician responsible for the invasion of that district, for the dispossession of your people. And then, you know, these monuments and memorials often kind of reinforce that. So, you know, I think that we're at the point where we need to have conversations around how this history is remembered, whether that is in monuments and memorials, which are often, you know, these are often reflections of the priorities and value systems of those who erected them. So many of the New Zealand Wars memorials, for example, were erected in the early 20th century, and many of them are monuments to imperialism and colonialism. So I think we need to have discussions around those, and it's not simply a case necessarily of they should all remain or they should all go. There are other ways of dealing with these, whether that's through providing additional contextualization, such as information panels that provides a missing perspective on that history, monuments and memorials alongside them. There are a range of things you can do. Likewise with, you know, street names and other things like that, I think we really need to have those conversations about those, and that needs to be driven by Mana Whenua.
And just finally, and I thank you for your time, Vincent, today is also the anniversary of the signing of the Whakaputunga. Many still adhere to that. What influence do you think that this has or should have as we acknowledge the period that you've delved into so closely? What's your thinking on this aspect of Māori sovereignty?
Well, I think he whakaputanga is, was a powerful assertion of Māori and rangatiratanga by the 52 rangatira who signed it between 1835 and 1839. And, of course, that included Te Whiriwhiri, who went on to become the first Māori king. So there's a direct connection there. And he whakaputanga in the later 19th century is often cited by Māori as they seek to gain redress for various grievances, as they seek to establish their own Māori parliament and so on. So it becomes a very powerful symbol of really all that Māori fought for in the New Zealand Wars. So there's that connection with it. And I think that continues through to the present as well.
As always, I appreciate your thoughts and insights to this period of our lives and you know, a day to pause and reflect, as you quite rightly mentioned, Te Rau Maumahara. Vincent O'Malley, historian with us today. Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you, Dale.